anyway. Okay, so, well, I'm going to, for my outline, stick to the three line, question? Oh. Yeah, I know Raphael didn't. You grew up in Germany. Yes, I know. Now, in past years, I've been able to touch the ball and even kick it forward. Anyway, for my outline, I'm going to stick to the three-line haiku format set out by Sean a few weeks back. So line one is space-time singularities. Line two, string theory. And as Sean so aptly noted, three is the sum of one and two.
You lost a page.
And I lost a page. Okay. Now, Sean gave kind of an overview of superstring cosmology, this program. And there are a number of specific points of contact between string theory and cosmology, several of which would make interesting stories. And the one I'm going to focus on is the issue of space-time singularities. So first, let me give some sort of definition of a singularity. A place, not a very precise definition, a place where the known laws of physics break down. Now I've got to define known. And specifically due to some field or curvature becoming infinite. So in the context of general relativity, the two famous and important singularities are the black hole singularity. So if you have a localized mass, if it's contained within a region whose size is of order its Schwarzschild radius, then light will be trapped. There'll be a trapped surface at which all of the light rays, even the ones trying to get out, are actually converging. And now this situation as it stands is not singular. Everything is perfectly smooth so far. But a theorem of Penrose implies that if you wait a finite amount of time, evolve the system forward, after a finite amount of time, you will not be able to go any further. The laws of general relativity will break down. And let me draw just a piece of a space-time diagram of this. Time and radius, and here is your mass, and it gets smaller due to gravity. And again, some finite time in the future, you encounter something beyond which you can't evolve, presumably because the curvature is becoming infinite, although the theorem doesn't actually say that. And there's more to this diagram, which I'll actually draw later, but this is all I need to draw now. So this is the radius and the time. That's one example of a cosmological singularity. And another one is, roughly speaking, the time reverse. The universe is expanding, as you saw. The galaxies are flying apart. I should have said here, by the way, this theorem make certain assumptions about what the matter can do, in particular, for example, that the energy density is always non-negative. So the universe is expanding, and as you run this backwards, there is a time reverse of this situation, of this something, a time reverse of the same theorem. Did a Hawking and Penrose. Which implies that there's a singularity in the past. And let me draw again a space-time picture, just a very rudimentary one. Here's the past singularity. Everywhere in the past, you run into something that you can't evolve beyond. So in these contexts, the known laws of physics mean general relativity. Now, string theory is supposed to be more than just the known theory of gravity. It's supposed to be the complete theory of gravity and everything else. And so it should tell us what exactly happens here or here. Now, this singularity we can't see. Although black holes exist in nature, this singularity is hidden behind an event horizon. And so the only way to probe its physics is to throw something in and follow its evolution. But this singularity, of course, is visible to us because every light ray that we receive, if you follow it back far enough, hits that singularity. And so the state of the universe today depends on what happened there. And so understanding how string theory resolves this singularity is very much tied up with the important question of what are the initial conditions for cosmology. Now, the initial conditions for cosmology involve many things other than singularities. In particular, as Hartle and Hawking showed, in some contexts, actually, you can separate out the interesting question from the physics of the singularity. But there are some specific recent models of cosmology which do have singularities, and where, moreover, something very specific is supposed to happen at that past singularity. And I'll say more about what those models are and what has to happen at the singularity when I get to part three. But now I'm going to move on to part two. Okay, so string theory is supposed to be complete and not break down anywhere and tell us exactly what the answer is to any well-posed physical question. And in fact, there are a lot of examples we have of where string theory does this in a situation that was singular in quantum field theory. And the simplest is just the field of an electron. The electron has both electric and gravitational fields, which classically, non-relativistically, blow up as 1 over r squared, leading to an infinite self-energy. And, of course, when you go to quantum theory, quantum field theory, this classical picture is modified. The details of how the singularity works are modified. But nevertheless, it remains true that the situation is physically singular, that if you ask questions about things happening at high enough energies, the theory breaks down. And this is a very old problem, and lots of ways of fixing it have been tried. And there is one that works, and it's this. There's one that we know that works, and it's replacing that point with a little loop. Now, that's a strange idea, certainly not an obvious idea, and it took a long time to gain any sort of acceptance. But in fact, as I said, lots of things have been tried and don't work. It turns out that these, in the context of quantum field theory, these singularity problems are very hard. Renormalizability problems are very hard to solve. It's not that you're presented with an enormous number of consistent theoretical solutions to choose from. And as I said, in this case, we know of one. And not only does it solve this problem, but of course, it solves it in a very beautiful way that unifies many of the things that we're trying to do in particle physics and gravity, unified general relativity, gauge theory, grand unification, supersymmetry, and so on. Of course, part of the story is that these fields themselves, the quanta of them, are also made of the same stuff, the photon or graviton, and there's only this one kind of object seen in different states of excitation. So there's one example, the sort of the prototype example of how string theory resolves a the blue's gotten really big. Anyway, here's a prototype example of how string theory resolves what was previously a singular situation. Now, this is not a very space-timey singularity. So I want to go on to another example in which the singularity is more obviously geometric in character, as it was in the space-time examples. And so to try to maintain the high standards of showmanship of recent blackboard lunches, I brought a space-time singularity with me, or rather a spatial singularity. So this is a space, of course, which is smooth everywhere except at the point where the curvature is infinite, or at least in principle infinite. And of course, as you know, a cone is not only smooth everywhere, but its intrinsic geometry is flat everywhere, because I can open it out into a flat piece of paper. And this particular cone, as you'll see, was built from a semicircle. And that was deliberate because since it has an opening angle of 180 degrees. To walk around a closed path and get back where you started, you go through not 360 degrees, but exactly half of that, 180 degrees. And the nice thing about that is there's a simple way to describe this space. You can take one copy of it, and I put a couple of stars here. And then I can use the method of images. That is, as I walk around here, I'm supposed to come back to my starting point. And a simple way to describe that as an electrostatics is to just glue on a second copy of the same space. And so everything on the first copy is just duplicated. So it's just like the method of images from electrostatics. You can describe wave propagation and so on the cone by describing it actually on the non-singular flat blackboard and just insist that everything be even under identification through the origin. Now, using that description, we could do quantum field theory on this space, and it would still be singular because when, say, some field approaches the origin, so does its image, and there'll be some kind of singularity in the amplitudes there. But in fact, string theory on this space is non-singular. There is a stringy implementation of the method of images called an orbifold, which for this space and for other spaces which are built from flat space by this process of identification, it gives a complete and non-singular description. So one can, on this conic space with the conic singularity, calculate any kind of stringy scattering amplitude and get a finite and well-defined answer. So here's an example of a space whose physics is singular in field theory and well-defined in string theory. Now again, I chose 180 degrees especially so that I could cover the plane with two of them. And had I chosen the opening angle of the cone to be any integer fraction of 360 degrees, I could similarly cover the plane with n wedges, and the same construction shows that it gives a non-singular construction of string theory in this space. In fact, though, it only works for these angles. So this is a nice example because it shows something that this resolution of singularities by string theory is a subtle thing. It's not that any singular space-time that you are interested in is automatically smoothed in some way by string theory. Rather, there are some systematics to it, and there are some spaces, namely these, which are good solutions to string theory, and there are others, namely any other opening angle, which are not solutions to string theory.
But that's not true for the resolution of the self-energy there?
Well, it's... Well, in some sense, yes. For example, every string theory has gravity in it. So if you were given a singularity that had an electric field and no gravitational field, that's not something that can descend from string theory. So I mean, even in this case, there are.
But also, there's a space-time background for which one does anything.
It has to be a solution to the field equations. I mean, I thought you were asking, or could have been asking, it would be good if string theory uniquely predicted the properties of the electron. That is, that was the only thing that could be resolved. And this is a long story, which...
Or at least restricted.
This is one of the stories that I did not choose to get into today. Okay. Now, both the electron and this conic singularity, this orbifold singularity, have a simplifying feature, which is that they're static. In both cases, you're dealing with a static situation, or of course you could put things into some kind of slow adiabatic evolution. But they don't have the distinguishing feature of the cosmological singularities that there is strong time dependence, and that the singularity is something which develops in time. Now, in some ways, space and time aren't so different, and in some ways, they're very different. And again, in part three, I will get to time-dependent singularities, and we'll see both those things. But I want to discuss a couple of other interesting examples of these static singularities, because they're interesting stories. And again, the word orbifold is for these things which are constructed by the method of images. So now, as you go up in dimension, actually there are lots of different kinds of singularities which are more or less cone-like. Where'd my cone go? Here it is. The thing about two dimensions is that basically the cone has a base. And in two dimensions, about the only choice you can have for the base is a circle. But as you go to higher dimensions, the base will be, in four dimensions, the base will be three-dimensional, and there are various three-dimensional spaces that might serve as the base of the cone, and so there are various kinds of three-dimensional cone. I can't draw these on the blackboard very well, so everything I draw will look like the same kind of cone. So here's a space which is, again, non-singular, and it's a piece of a space. There's more to it, and it solves Einstein's equations, or the stringy generalization of Einstein's equations. But there's a one-parameter family of these solutions. By the way, the thing I'm describing here is called a flop. And there's something very similar, which is called a conifold. And there's a one-parameter family of these. And in particular, we can reach a solution which is singular, like that. And once again, one's ability to calculate, say, in general relativity would break down as the curvature becomes Planckian. But in string theory, we in fact can calculate even here. And what one finds is that the picture doesn't end, but you can continue like this. And the space can change its topology. And remarkably, many of the principles in the things I'm talking about are here today. This was the discovery of Brian Greene and collaborators.
Is this just a spatial figure, Joe?
This is just a spatial figure. Right now, everything for now is just a spatial figure with time being static. And it's, again, a low-dimensional projection of a higher-dimensional picture, but this captures the flavor. So it's an old question in string theory, in general relativity. In general relativity, space-time can bend. That's what gravity is. But in general relativity, you don't know space-time can break, because where the topology changes, general relativity breaks down. And now we know in string theory that in a number of very controlled circumstances, maybe not in all cases, but in a number of very controlled circumstances, the topology of space-time can change. Now, how is this understood? Well, there's an alternate dual description of this same process. The actual duality is something known as mirror symmetry. And there's an alternate description in which the description is manifestly smooth. I can give you sort of a flavor of how this works. The important thing is that a string has an intrinsic size. A string has an intrinsic size set by its tension and h bar. So there's some, given the tension h bar, there is some length scale that the uncertainty principle tells you it will tend to fluctuate at. And once you talk about geometric features that are smaller than the characteristic size of the string, strings see space-time differently from point particles, differently from normal notions of geometry and topology. Basically, what happens is this. You should think about the string as a little one-dimensional universe. And to study its physics, you're really studying quantum, you're studying something a little bit more abstract. You are studying quantum field theory in one space and one time dimension. So you have this abstract one plus one dimensional quantum field theory, and only in certain limits does the interpretation of in terms of a string moving in a higher dimensional space-time emerge. As you go to geometries which are small compared to a string, or whose features are small compared to a string, the space-time picture really doesn't mean anything anymore, and you just have this abstract description in terms of the quantum field theory. And again, in this case, it's known through that the abstract description is smooth, even though the geometric description is apparently discontinuous. Okay, one more example. Any questions?
What happens to the field theory on the string Wiltshire at the singularity? I mean, does something qualitative happen, or is that not?
I think in this case, nothing qualitative, because in the mirror description, it really is a smooth transition. Is that?
Well, in the flop transition, nothing, but the
right.
Monofold.
Right. Actually, good. So in fact, not in this case, but another. What happens more generally is that from the point of view. Well, where these singularities are normally encountered is not in the non-compact four dimensions, but in the compact dimensions that we don't see. And one of the interesting things is that as you go through a transition like this, what very often happens is that from the four-dimensional point of view, you have a phase transition. So you'll have a state of one symmetry here, a state of a different symmetry here, and a critical point with some extra massless degrees of freedom here. So, you know, this is actually a nice example of the fact that with, you know, compact extra dimensions, there is this mapping between geometry in the higher dimensions and physics in the lower. So a discontinuous change of topology maps onto a phase transition, at least in many cases. Okay, and the final tool that I want to mention is one that Tom mentioned last week, ADS-CFT duality. So this is sort of our deepest thing that we know about string theory, which is that in certain spacetimes, in the ADS space whose metric Tom wrote, string theory in the bulk of that space is identical to, it's the same theory in different variables as some quantum field theory on the boundary. And again, this is amazing from many points of view. This theory has gravity and all kinds of stuff. This is just really a quantum field theory that you could put on a computer and chug away. This lives in 5 or 10 dimensions, and this in 4. So this mapping between these variables is both non-trivial and non-local. Nevertheless, it seems to be true. And in the cases where this, like again, this is only available for string theory and some fairly restricted geometries. But where it's available, one has an in principle complete description of the theory in the terms of the dual variables, where again, this is something that you could feed to a computer and calculate anything. And I should say, this picture is in some ways more complete than this picture. What I'm describing here with the mirror symmetry and the 1+1 dimensional quantum field theory is sort of the stringy analog of classical general relativity. That is, points have been replaced by loops, and so it's different in important ways, but the space-time background is still not quantized. This is a description which is fully quantum. That is, you do the path integral on the boundary, and you're describing all possible geometries in the interior. And now, there are various examples that have been studied of singularities in the interior. So in this duality, the boundary conditions on the metric at infinity is fixed, but the metric in the interior is dynamical and can do lots of things. And in particular, with appropriate initial conditions, singularities will develop in here. And for those singularities which are static, not for the ones which are strongly time dependent, one in general has an understanding in the dual quantum field theory in terms of some symmetry breaking transition or in terms perhaps of some light degrees of freedom in the boundary theory. And again, this...
now is there a deep understanding of why the asymptotic behavior metric has to be so special? Is there some deep understanding or just mathematical understanding at this point? Only a couple examples, no, right? ABS and...
It tend to be examples where the geometry is very rigid at the boundary.
Well,
in some sense, because one of the things that makes quantum gravity so hard to get a handle on is because when space-time itself fluctuates, you don't know what the observables are, something that Tom emphasized. And so here's a case where you do have in the interior geometry which is fluctuating freely, but because of the negative spatial curvature, it effectively becomes rigid at infinity, and so that's a pretty special property.
I may not have understood what Tom said, but mm-hmm. he tried to do it for de Sitter. Now, what is the story for de Sitter? You guys don't know how to do it, or is it known that it doesn't work,
For flat space, we don't know how to do it. For de Sitter, we don't know, and I would make different guesses from Tom. So I guess that is the definition of not knowing. Yeah. And again, several of the principles are here. Clifford just arrived today. Clifford, Amanda, and I think found the first, not the first, there are lots of examples of this, but one of the first examples. Okay. So there's part two. There's sort of our bag of tricks for understanding singular space-times, static singular space-times in string theory. And as you see, it really is, at this level, sort of a bag of tricks. It's not that we have a global understanding, but we have a series. We have a lot of different methods that apply in most of the cases that we would like to understand. So now let me come back to space-time singularities and pose a more precise question for string theory. So let me first plot the standard model, the inflationary model of the history of our universe. Here's time. Here is the scale factor. So this is just the relative size of the universe at different times. It went through a period of exponential expansion. That's inflation. Presumably with a singularity before there, but that doesn't really matter in the inflationary cosmology, not directly. Then a period of radiation and matter domination. And finally, we're back making a transition to an exponentially expanding, accelerating phase today. And the point of the inflationary period is twofold. First of all, what does one want to try to explain? Well, once, if you look at the microwave background in different directions of the sky, its temperature is 2.7 Kelvin. And as you look in different directions of the sky, you might see temperature differences 4 or 5 orders of magnitude smaller than that. And although they're very small, these fluctuations are exactly what one needs to grow in the subsequent phases through gravitational attraction into the galaxies and us. And so a theory of cosmology has to explain, first of all, why the universe, so this is the earliest thing we see, the microwave background, why at that earliest time the universe is so remarkably homogeneous and yet not perfectly homogeneous. And slow roll inflation does that in a beautiful way, because the expansion, first of all, spreads out, smears out, so you don't see them, any initial inhomogeneities. And then at the late stages, the quantum fluctuations of the inflaton field form and eventually grow to become this and to become us. So it's a remarkably simple and beautiful picture which fits the data, the recent data, fantastically well. So for example, there's this delta T arises from some fluctuation of the metric, some dimensionless fluctuation of the metric, which is a function of wave number. And this has some spectrum with respect to momentum. And inflation predicts that this spectral index here is very close to 1, within a few percent of 1, but in different models of inflation, its value differs from 1 by small, interesting amounts. And the current measurements are that this is, I think it's 0.97 plus or minus 0.04. So we're talking about a high precision science, but also one where in the future there might be interesting possibilities to distinguish between different models. There are other things that can be measured. This is not a perfect power law, so there's the deviation from power law. There's the ratio of scalar to tensor fluctuations. Inflation seems to work quite well, but that doesn't prove that it's right. There are, depending on who you talk to, issues with how you initiated it. But even if it works perfectly, it's nice to have other models to compare it to. And there are other models out there in which the history of the universe, the early history of the universe, is very different. Namely, it's supposed to look something like this. It's getting smaller instead of bigger. Goes down to somewhere essentially zero, and then comes out again without the inflationary phase, directly in some kind of power law expansion, and then to us. Now, again, inflation is supposed to do two things for you: smooth out the initial situation and produce the fluctuations. The smoothing out is very controversial here. But leaving that aside, the interesting thing about this is the fluctuations that grow into us in these cosmologies form not after this point, but before. So the models here are the pre-Big Bang due to Gabriella and collaborators, and the ekpyrotic / cyclic cosmology due to Curie over at Steinhardt and Turek. Now, again, there's lots of questions to be answered here, but for these models present a very specific issue for string theory, which is what happens here at the singularity. Because in these cosmologies, everything satisfies Einstein's equations here and here, but Einstein's equations very definitely break down where the scale factor goes to zero. Again, one of the singularity theorems tells you that since you're in a contracting phase here, general relativity by itself reaches a point where it can't carry things further. And so these...
I don't now think there's a singularity in the past. There's a get out in the singularity theorems. So maybe we don't need string theory.
The statement is, Stephen doesn't believe the singularity in the past. There's an out in the singularity theorems. Well, one of the outs is that a positive cosmological constant doesn't satisfy the energy conditions and you can bounce. Is that more or less the out? When I talked about initial conditions, I said that singularities were not the only issue, but one I'm going to focus on. But even if there's not an initial singularity, I'll argue with your conclusion about not needing string theory. Yes?
What would be the argument?
Oh. By the way,
can you say what would be the argument? You say that you would argue with...
Well, actually, instead of following this point now, let me provide an advertisement. The title of Stephen's talk at our conference in 2 weeks is A Non-Singular Universe. So it sounds like... Okay. But what I want to talk about is these models which do need string theory. They need us very much. Because they need string theory to tell them that this is, in fact, a solution to the equation. This is, in fact, a space-time that can happen. I should say what's done now is more or less, and there's different ways to do this leading to different predictions, a sort of phenomenological cutoff where you sort of stop the collapse and restart it and match the fluctuations on the two sides. And there are a number of ways to impose the cutoff and do the matching, which do or do not produce spectral indices close to one as they're supposed to.
Just by hand.
Just consider take a space-time metric which goes down to near but not exactly zero and study fluctuations in that metric. And since you're studying fluctuations in the metric itself, it's obviously a delicate question how you impose that cutoff. And in some ways of imposing the cutoff, you get 1 for this index, which is what it's supposed to be. In other ways, you get 3. But even the models which give 3 can try to get 1 by adding another field in.
And you have to do it in such a way to be diffeomorphic invariant, gauge invariant, and all that.
Right. That's what you need to do in principle, right? It would be better to simply have a complete understanding, I mean, really have a calculation in string theory. Now, the ekpyrotic model is particularly nice in the context of what I've been saying because, let me first describe it briefly. In the ekpyrotic model, you have these two brains, which are extended in all of the three directions you see. This is a fourth spatial dimension, a fifth dimension. And these brains are rushing at each other. And they're supposed to be parallel. And these brains actually are not simply immersed in a higher dimensional space. These brains are walls at which this fifth dimension ends. So the fifth dimension is an interval. It's an interval, and it ends here at this brain, and it ends here at this brain, and this interval is shrinking. Now, these walls at the end of the universe are things that exist in string theory. Again, you can describe, they're like perfect mirrors. And again, you can describe them with this orbifold construction where you have an object on one side of the orbifold and its mirror image on the other. So these exist. And now in the ekpyrotic universe, these brains rush at each other and bounce. Although actually the way the ekpyrotic people like to think about it is they don't bounce, they pass through each other. And so if I draw this process in time, you get, here's the universe, here's the fifth dimension, getting smaller and bigger again. And that doesn't look so terribly dramatic. In fact, that's very much like the cone, because the space is flat everywhere except at this one point. And in fact, there's a real sense in which this ekpyrotic space-time is an analytic continuation of the cone. I said that space and time are not so different, and in fact, if you take an analytic continuation of the cone, you get this. Raphael, question?
You said a little earlier that the thing that you basically trust or know how to do is taking this background and then calculating perturbations on it, fields that live on it.
Yes.
But you wouldn't know how to actually calculate the evolution of the background strictly in string theory.
Well, okay, so let me go on and see if I answer your question. So the statement...
What I want to know is, do you have any argument that the second part of this picture is actually going to emerge in real-time evolution?
Okay, so... this is, through the orbifold construction, a classical solution to the string field equations. That much is true. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean it's acceptable because there are certain questions of global structure, but let me leave that aside. Those are a little bit complicated. But there's a more question. There's a question that you can answer more directly, which is, even if this is a solution to the gravitational field equations in string theory as it stands, does it retain this form when you consider quantum fluctuations in this background? Does quantum mechanics spoil it? Or for that matter, if you have not just the vacuum solution, but as Raphael said, if you have some matter around, if you have some fluctuations around, because they have to go through, what happens if you add fluctuations to this picture? And so several groups calculated string amplitudes in this background to see if it was stable against these perturbations, and it's not. And the reason it's not is really very simple, and was pointed out by Gary Horowitz many years ago, which is that if you've got a box, a space-time that's shrinking, well, let's put some kind of particle in that box in some wave function, then as it shrinks, the wavelength is blue-shifted, and so the energy goes up. And if we're talking now about a situation where the box actually shrinks to zero and tries to go through, there's an instant where the blue shift goes to infinity. You've got infinite energy and potentially infinite back reaction. And again, now it's a question, do you really have infinity, or does string theory fix this? And you do the calculation, and it doesn't fix it. That is, you look at the string amplitudes in this space-time, and you find that they diverge exactly where the naive argument based on the blue shifting tells you that they would. It tells you that instead of having this nice, smooth, orbifold-type singularity, in fact, things collapse to infinite curvature. And one doesn't know what to say next. This is still an open question, because at this point, now that the first order correction has totally spoiled the zeroth order picture, one doesn't have any tools for calculating. So what one can say is that the apparent smoothness of the ekpyrotic singularity is an illusion. What happens there is much more complicated. And we don't have any controlled approximation. We don't know the answer. We don't have any controlled approximation to, or for that matter, a numerical construction to try to push this forward. At this point in time, all you can say is that nowhere in string theory do we have any controlled description of a bouncing space-time. Doesn't mean it doesn't happen, and so people are still free to impose phenomenological cutoffs and discuss which one makes more sense than which other one, but we can't tell them which or whether any makes sense. Yes?
From the point of view of string theory, do you think there's any prejudice in favor of drawing this picture at all, or could there be three elephants coming out at that point?
I mean, why would you spend any time thinking about this if you have absolutely no idea what's going to come out of it?
You're absolutely right. So, all right, I mean, if you ask me, well, if you ask me what do I think comes out of the bounds, is it something fairly smooth or is it three elephants? Well, I think actually the time stops there. Now, what that means, I'm not going to say, because I'm deliberately avoiding metaphysics in this talk. I could have given an entirely metaphysical talk.
That you have in another universe.
Or in another week, for that matter. Yes. But what I will do is tell you why I think that. And this comes back to, I'm actually going to finish early, so those of you who got here at noon will actually not be cheated. let me come back to the black hole singularity, the shrinking star, the spatial singularity, and now let me draw the rest of the picture. So again, this is the convention that Tom Banks mentioned last week, that light rays travel at 45 degrees. So here's kind of the last light ray to get out. Over here at infinity, way outside the black hole, is the observers.
Joe?
Yes?
Have people tried to generalize the singularity theorem of general relativity to string theory, or presumably?
They've certainly tried. It's, you know, so it's...
Say when you get a singularity and when not, right?
Even in the context of classical stringy geometry, so sort of the level of the flop, there's a well-posed question, which no one has really succeeded in making any progress on. So, I mean, the first step is to write down some analog of the Ray-Chudorie equation, which tells you some focusing of geodesics. Mm-hmm. And I've tried to think a little bit about what that would mean in this more abstract context of 1 plus 1 dimensional quantum field theory. And I wouldn't be surprised if at that classical level there is some, especially in the absence of any counterexample, that there is some theorem. Even if that were proven, it wouldn't exclude the possibility of strongly quantum, of quantum systems having a bounce. So here's the collapsing star, the singularity, the last light ray to get out, the observers in infinity, and this is an evaporating black hole. So past a certain point, it's not there anymore, and this is just a non-singular space-time. That's the origin. Now, if cosmological singularities can bounce like this, it seems fairly plausible that black hole singularities should bounce as well. And a little baby universe break off.
But you just said we have no evidence for that, right?
I said if. If this can happen. Now, of course, this singularity is not the same necessarily as a cosmological singularity, but they're not so different. And again, due to the strong back reaction, they're pretty similar at the end of the day. They both have curvatures going to infinity. And so if you can understand what happens here, it's reasonable to extrapolate it to cosmology. And we have good reason to think that this doesn't happen. And that's because if this happened, black hole evolution would not be unitary, information would be lost. You would have some state on the initial surface, and some part of the state would go off into the baby universe, and the observers at infinity would not see it all. There would not be a unitary map from the initial states to the final states. And as I said, our most global construction of string theory now is this ADS-CFT construction, where the observers at infinity are the people on the wall. And in fact, you can set up this entire situation in the interior. That is, you can establish initial conditions which would lead to the formation of a black hole singularity and its eventual evaporation. And in the context of the dual quantum field theory, this is an entirely unitary process. There's a unitary map from the initial state to the final state. So through this indirect argument, again, it becomes rather indirect, but it's fairly convincing. Yes?
If there's a analytic crunch.
Yes.
What is the analytic continuation of a loss of information or unitarity breakdown problem? And what is the analogous?
What is the analogous problem here? It's an interesting question, but it's a question which does not be. If you think about a cosmological singularity as filling space-time, you don't have the observers at infinity, and so you don't have the analogous issue.
This would be an issue for someone in the black hole.
The person in the black hole doesn't have an information problem, right? That just to pose the information problem, you've got to pose it from the point of view of someone outside who sees the entire process from a non-singular past to a non-singular future. So it doesn't have an obvious analog in cosmology. Yeah?
I'm trying to understand your argument why a bouncing black hole would be in conflict. It's more in conflict with unitarity than a non-bouncing one. I mean, is the argument that the information would be inside the black hole in the new universe, so it can't also be outside?
Yeah, a person...
Can't you then also apply to the argument to the state in the black hole before the crunch?
Let's talk about this later, but you can think about an observer in this case who could actually see more than one copy of the same information. He sees the Hawking radiation come out, hops in, and sees the second copy. Mark?
How do you know that the unitary field theory evolution doesn't describe exactly this picture on the left?
The picture on the left. Again, because the claim would be that it would seem to this picture on the left appears to describe a non-unitary map from this slice to this slice. And here we have a unitary map from here to here.
Maybe this is getting too technical.
We should probably continue, right. We should probably, for the sake of the pattern people, continue the black hole discussion later. Actually, so the last thing I want to say, and then I really am done, is that one of the things that makes this ADS-CFT duality sort of less effective, one of the reasons I'm making a rather indirect argument here is because this particular singularity is hidden behind a horizon and can't be seen directly from infinity. So I was making this indirect argument about unitary evolution. In fact, just in the past week, or few weeks, Thomas Hertog, Gary Horowitz, and Ken Maeda have found examples where you can construct seemingly within, again, the interior of this ADS-CFT dual space-time a naked cosmological singularity, one which is actually visible. Well, first of all, it violates or may violate certain theorems and cause certain bets to be lost.
It doesn't violate any theorems, conjectures.
Conjectures, yes, doesn't violate theorems. Yes. but moreover, it presents a very nice set of puzzles and makes it possible that this tool of ours, the ADS-CFT duality, will really be able to enable us to say more precise things about what happens at a space-time singularity. So that's where we are this week. Thank you.
Any questions from the pattern people?
When you talked about the Big Bang, yes, you said, well, you don't have to worry about the singularity. That was said at what level?
Okay. When I mentioned Hartle and Hawking, there's two halves of the story there. One is that if you have a positive vacuum energy, a positive cosmological constant, these singularity theorems no longer apply because you can have a universe which actually contracts and re-expands. That's not useful for these ekperiodic and so on stories I was talking about. But what Hartle and Hawking described was a complete cosmology where you essentially tunneled through a Euclidean process to an inflating universe of finite size, and then that inflated and then decayed to our universe. And so you sort of avoided the singularity in the complex plane. I'm not sure if the more important greening there is the quantumness of the cosmology or the fact that you have a positive cosmological constant. At least part of the question of the initial conditions can be decoupled from the question of singularities in an inflationary universe. Do you want to amplify that, Stephen or Jim, or correct it?
I thought the,
question, I don't know, maybe I misunderstood it, but I thought his question was why you should not worry about the Big Bang singularity in equation.
So up here, did I answer, could you want to re-ask? I'm sorry, maybe I misunderstood the question.
Can you repeat the question?
No, I mean, you just said...
Because you said that what? You don't worry about
it. I didn't have it that... Mm-hmm. You just said we don't have to worry about the singularity, and so...
Excuse me. This is when I drew this picture.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, within inflation.
Okay.
Yes.
I'm sorry. There's a...
It sounded like your answer was answering my question.
First of all, regardless of what happens, one of the things about inflation is this expansion of the universe smooths things out so much that you don't really, you aren't much affected by what happens there. So however that's resolved, within some range of possibilities, you really can't see the singularity. One of the things which Paul Steinhardt likes to emphasize about the aperiodic cosmology, which makes it interesting if true, and also the pre-Big Bang, is that unlike the singularity here, which is hidden by inflation, in the bouncing universes, we've been processed through the singularity. You can see back to the singularity, and so you can hope to see stringy physics. So from that point of view, we should hope that this bounce occurs. Unfortunately, it seems like maybe the opposite's true. Yeah.
Let's see, are we finished with the pattern people? Because I'm not a... I have a question, right, which is related to, I think, what you said. All the descriptions which you've given, of bounces and so forth, have a sort of fixed space-time of some kind with the bounce, which I think you have to presume that the fluctuations are going to be small,
yes.
Fluctuations. But from Gary's analysis, right, we know that when you get a bounce like that, the fluctuations are likely to be big, and that's what you've shown as well. So, wouldn't a better description be to describe this thing in terms of some sort of... in ordinary quantum mechanics, we have big fluctuations. We mm-hmm. describe that in terms of the state, or the wave function of the system.
Yes.
Wouldn't it be better off to describe this sort of thing, not in terms of some fixed background plus perturbations,
but through the wave?
In terms of the state itself?
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. That, by the way, is a partial answer to the question you just asked. The important thing is the quantumness of the cosmology.
Right. There's two possible answers. One is that the back reaction grows to enormous size here, only really in a very tiny fraction of a string time. So one hope might have been that that the cutoff occurs before the back reaction gets large. And so what you're saying isn't needed. Now, in fact, In fact, in its latest incarnation, one of the proposals from the ekpyriotic cyclic group is that in fact the back reaction does become large, but in a way which is harmless. And they're remarkably agile. This is this ultra local thing where you go into a one of these. Mixmaster. You go into some kind of mixmaster where things locally become chaotic, pass through the singularity, and then you time reverse and get back to the small fluctuations you had before. It's like I said, they're very agile, but you got to admire them. Okay.
I just had a comment about your statement about there being general theorems which tell you that the singularities, no matter what you're. Background theory is general relativity or string theory.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think in the one context which people are very enamored of, which is eternal inflation, which mm-hmm. you might like or not like, there's a recent claim, relatively recent, by Borde, Belenkin, and Guth, that there's a kinematic proof that there's a past singularity that does not depend on the equation of motion.
Right, right. I have not studied this, and yeah, I haven't studied it. It's an interesting point, right? Because inflation. By going on very long can erase your knowledge of initial singularity, but it can't evade it entirely. That's their point. Yeah. But again, the quantum, you can go around it in the Euclidean complex plane.
Okay. Let's thank Joe again.
Yes.